Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Having a few bad days at work is like totally normal. Don't worry about it. But if you dread going into work every day, you probably have contemplated quitting once or twice. That is not an easy decision to make, especially if you don't know what your next move might be. Jennifer Turlick is the CEO of Maker Kids, and she has written a book that tries to help people navigate a big career decisions. It's called How to Figure Out What to Do with Your Life Next. Now, career is a big area of our financial lives. So is real estate. And things are moving so fast in that sector right now. We're going to talk to Joe Jacobs. He is managing director of Mortgage Connection based in Calgary. And we're going to talk about what is going on right now in this very minute in the mortgage market. Then financial productivity in just 5 minutes. It's like that TV commercial for Minute Rice. Remember that from the 80s? Long grain rice. It's ready in 5 minutes. Easy Money has a weekly newsletter, and it includes a little feature called 5 Minute Money Tasks. It's fascinating. What you can get done in such a short amount of time is really pretty amazing. Hannah Horvath from Easy Money is going to be here to tell us what to expect from those little tasks. Filing your taxes is no fun, at least for me. I hate doing it. If you're someone living on a low income, you might be facing additional barriers when it comes to filing. And it's so important that you do, because that's the way that you can get some of the benefits that the government of Canada is offering. We're going to talk to Jeff Loomis from the nonprofit Momentum. And he's going to talk about their free tax clinic and also about some of the barriers that people on a lower income face. Plus, Nancy Tengler will be here. She is the author of the book, The Women's Guide to Successful Investing. Ooh, I'm so excited. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. Get this. Not everyone out there on planet Earth absolutely loves their job. It's true. It's true. And if you happen to be stuck in a job that you do not love, you have probably thought about quitting, maybe even like 4,000 times. There is a certain cinematic quality to our own very personal I quit moments. But then what? What happens in the movie next? The harder part, I think, is figuring out what it is that you are going to do next if you do take that step. Jennifer Turlick is the CEO of Maker Kids. She wrote a book that might be able to help with that step. It's called How to Figure Out What to Do with Your Life Next. She joins us now. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
You come to this topic from personal experience. You went to a great business school. You got a great job at Procter & Gamble afterwards, which is where we first met. What was the light bulb moment for you that there was a better way to navigate your career?
Well, I was just waking up every day and sort of dreading going into work after I'd been there for a little while. And then when I was getting home, I was falling asleep at around 6 p.m. So like right when I got home, and I thought, you know, there must be a better way than this.
I should be.
Yeah, pretty much. It seemed like a big drain. And also I was just, not really enjoying what I was doing and thinking there must be something different that I could like.
A part of this process for you was a trip down to Silicon Valley. And I think this is the thing that really resonates for me about your book, because I've read about 4,000 career books, but yours, what makes yours different in my mind is that you apply that latest and greatest thinking that they do down in those parts. What did you learn from Silicon Valley that you could apply to your career?
Yeah, so I wasn't sure what I wanted to do next. And I thought maybe some folks in Silicon Valley might be able to help me. So I quit and I flew there and I started cold emailing folks like founders, investors, and professors from places like Square and Kiva, as well as professors from Stanford. And a number of them were willing to meet with me, which was amazing. And I learned how to apply different principles from design thinking, lean methodology, and quantified self to career selection. So this idea of, instead of, for example, going straight to law school, having never experienced a day in the life of a lawyer, shadowing a lawyer, or doing an informational interview with them so you can get a better understanding of what it is you want to do and how you would actually like it before you make a serious investment of time.
Well, I mean, with law school, you can watch Law and Order, you can watch Street Legal. There's so many TV shows that give you an accurate characterization of what it would be like to be a lawyer, right? Kidding. Totally kidding.
I mean, yeah.
You're like, TV does not got to know.
Certainly have some elements of it, but it can be drastically different when you're there in person.
Not everybody's Judge Judy. Fair. Okay. Mm-mm. So you called this process the prototyping your career method. We're going to talk about some of the specific elements, but just give me the highlight. Like, what's the overall narrative here of this method?
For sure. So basically, you're going through a design process, but the design process is for yourself and for your own career. So in a lot of good design processes, they start with empathizing with the user, which in this case is yourself. So it's really about first getting to know yourself, which a lot of people might say, oh, I already know a lot about myself, but have you identified your key core values, your mission, your vision? And there's a lot of different ways you can do that, such as meditation, different career assessments, time for reflection. So that's the first step. And then once you've done that, to identify what are the key characteristics you're looking for in a career? So instead of a spray and pray approach where you basically apply to every job that you think might take you and go with the ones that'll take you, this is more of a targeted approach where you try and figure out what it is that you want and then create a really targeted application that can give you a better chance of success in getting that job. So once you've gotten to know yourself and figured out the characteristics you're looking for, then you would identify all the key areas that you think you might be interested in and figure out small ways to prototype them. Mm. You can start small with things like reading articles or doing informational interviews, and then go a deeper investment to do things like shadowing or internships, depending on your availability and level of interest, to then really hone in and see what are your top three that you're most interested in, and then developing the best application that you can for them, which might involve doing some extra education or projects to make yourself the best applicant for those positions.
What is one thing you learned about yourself in that first empathize with the client stage? I mean, I'm thinking like, what can I learn? I already know I like chocolate and, you know.
Well, I learned that I wanted to work in a small company, and I'd come from a huge company, but I realized that I'd like to work in a small team and that all of my favorite experiences had been in small team environments. So that was something that I learned. And I also learned that one of my biggest passions was helping more people get into careers that they like. I found out that over 80% of people are actually dissatisfied with their work. And I realized that was a big problem that I wanted to make a difference in. So that's how I got started with both Maker Kids and my book.
Almost sounds underreported, that figure, as huge as it is. So cast a net, narrow it down, the career design process, identifying options. Then there's this really great acronym that I hadn't heard, and I think it's genius. Minimum viable commitment. What does that phrase mean in this context, and how do you apply it?
So minimum viable commitment comes from the concept of minimal viable product in entrepreneurship, where entrepreneurs might create like what a service that could be the minimum required for a customer to achieve the goals that company is looking for them to have. For example, like a landing page that allows the user to sign up, and then in the back end, the company delivers the service that they're looking for. And in this case, as applied to careers, it's a minimum viable commitment is the minimum amount of information that you can try and get to determine whether or not you want to move to the next step of the process. So that might be a magazine article. There's sort of a spectrum from magazine articles and informational interviews all the way up to shadowing and internships, which would be higher commitment. So the idea of starting with smaller commitment smaller commitments and then going deeper into the ones that you find most interesting, because there's literally thousands of jobs out there. So this is a way for you to, instead of shadowing at thousands of different jobs, to narrow down and figure out which ones you're most interested in before investing further time and commitment into them.
What does shadowing look like? I mean, for some people, that's a hard thing to wrap their mind around because they don't have a network in the field that they would even like to move into. So what does it look like, and how can you get agreement from someone to let you hang around for the day?
So shadowing can mean different things to different people. It can mean different things to the person doing the shadowing as well as the person that you are shadowing. So I actually cold emailed a whole bunch of people in Silicon Valley, and I guess their emails in a lot of cases. And I was surprised that a number of them said yes to being willing to meet with me and or to shadow them. And I realized that not a lot of people were actually sending notes like that. And these people were often honored to have someone be interested in shadowing them. So their experiences ranged from doing admin work for a week for a for-profit startup in Silicon Valley to a different experience, which was I shadowed the CEO of Kiva, Matt Flannery, for a day. And I was his literal shadow. So we would go to meetings and people would say, oh, who's that? And so he would say, oh, actually, that's my shadow for the day. She's like an anthropological observer. We're just going to pretend she's not here. Genius. So it was an amazing experience to see what it was like. So yeah, shadowing can be different depending on the individual or organization. And there's lots of opportunities that you can find, especially if you pitch yourself and the value you might add to the person or organization, which could range from admin work to an opportunity for them to reflect.
You recommend people measure, which I totally get in the context of Silicon Valley. Facebook announces they're working on a new feature and they put it out there, the minimum viable product, and they measure it and see if people like it and how they use it. How do you measure a career?
I recommend measuring it based on those key areas that you set out in the beginning of the process in terms of what you're looking for in a career, which might range from size of organization to how good you are at it, salary, and that sort of thing. And it might sound like a cold way to go about it, but I think it's really helpful to basically take into account those different aspects in your selection, along with a healthy dose of serendipity and gut feel as well.
So and you're literally looking at numbers here. Like you're saying, I want a work-life balance that looks like this. Career A provides this level of work-life balance, so I'm giving them an 8. And career B gives a work-life balance of much less than that, so I'm giving them a 4.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you can assemble your total score for each job or each position that you're considering.
Wow. Did you find that you weighted particular variables? Like some people would say, you know, the number one thing for me is that I get to learn every single day. The work-life balance, I don't really care. So I would weight them differently.
Yeah. I weighted variables differently based on how important they were.
Like on a spreadsheet?
Oh, yeah.
What? Really? Do you show how to do that in the book?
I sure do. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So that then leads to the next phase, which is narrowing down that list. What wisdom do you have for making that choice?
So to narrow it down, you can take into account your measurements as well as, like I said, a healthy dose of serendipity and gut feel. And what's really important is when you're doing your shadow experiences or other minimum viable commitments to learn more about your opportunities, is that you're not like measuring it during the experience. For example, if you were on a date, it probably wouldn't be as good of a date if you were constantly thinking like, how do I like this? So it's important to try and have the experience like fully, participate fully in it. And then afterwards measure it and then narrow it down by picking, okay, what are the top ones from that set, from that round of experiences or choices? And do I want to narrow it down or keep them all in the mix? And then how can I narrow it further by doing a subsequent larger minimum viable commitment to then determine which ones you want to continue to pursue?
How do you factor in probability of success? And I ask that because when I left my packaged goods marketing world and said, I want to be on TV. I had no sense for how ridiculous an aspiration that was. I worked hard. I was very, very lucky and I was successful. But some people may have, they may discover something that is so fantastic. They want to be a journalist, for example, which is it's an industry that is fraught right now, versus if they wanted to be a social media manager or something like that, where there's just enormous opportunity.
Well, I think it all depends on the individual's comfort level. And I personally think that anyone can do anything using a growth mindset. I was literally speaking to my friend the other week who went from being an actress to a software engineer. Huge difference in those occupations, but it really depends on your comfort level and also how much you believe in the growth mindset or believe in your ability to do anything, as well as your financial comfort and, you know, whether you want to see how well you could do in a certain profession on the side of a current job, or whether you're willing to take the leap and try it fully, and both work. It's different for everyone.
Now, actress to software engineer. Had she played a software engineer on television? Because I think if
sure,
she had
actually
a shoe in, she'd go into the interview and she'd be like, oh, I totally auditioned for this part. I can completely make the dialogue sound real. You should ask her.
Yeah, I should. She actually went to a 9-week boot camp, a coding boot camp. And that's how she changed from being an actress to a software engineer. It's pretty amazing story.
The book is called How to Figure Out What to Do with Your Life Next. Jennifer Turlick is the author. And I got to tell you, as I said, I've read a lot of these types of books. Yours is different. Congratulations on that.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Many financial tasks take years to complete. Saving for retirement takes decades, right? Researching stocks, becoming really good at picking stocks can take years. Preparing a will takes weeks. Following a budget, like rigorously, takes hours. What could you really accomplish in just 5 minutes? Well, you're probably not going to be able to solve all your financial problems in that amount of time, but it could be a start. Easy Money by Policy Genius is this great weekly newsletter that shares tons of great tips. And one of the sections on this newsletter, which by the way, you have to sign up for, is 5-minute money tasks. Hannah Horvath is the deputy managing editor of Easy Money, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
So I read this 5-minute money task thing. And this is going to date me because I remember a TV commercial from the 80s where the spokesperson for Minute Rice said long grain rice that's ready in 5 minutes. That was the whole commercial. And if you don't know the commercial, you should look it up because you will know exactly what I'm talking about. What are you trying to do with 5-minute money tasks?
Yeah, so you kind of hit the nail on the head. We're not trying to, you probably can't change your entire life in 5 minutes, but it's definitely a start. You know, our goal for this section is really just to get our readers to take action. You know, our readers are busy, they're time poor, and they love and appreciate, you know, just actionable advice that they can start tackling head on. And so, you know, with this section, we break down these larger, complex financial tasks into these smaller steps. And it just makes it so much more manageable. And it really motivates you to kind of just get something done, get something checked off for the day. And it works especially well with, you know, things like budgeting or investing and all that stuff.
I want to talk about some examples. One of the ones that I talk about kind of in a broader way, but you put it on as a 5-minute task, is auto deposit. What are some things that people should just set and forget?
Yes. Anything. Well, I don't want to say anything, but most things related to savings.
I was going to say not anything. If you have like a cocaine habit, we don't want you to have like Harry's, eyeglass company sending you a monthly Coke run.
Yeah, I was going to say anything related to savings, but you know, the easy rule of thumb is anything related to savings, autopilot, anything, you know, that involves spending, maybe take kind of a closer look on, you know, what's just coming out of your checking account without you noticing. But yes, you know, the easiest way to kind of build up your savings without even thinking about it is just really setting and forgetting it.
Shutting off one-click ordering is number two. Now, the percentage of transactions that occur online in the US is significantly higher than it is here in Canada, but it's, you know, with the pandemic, people are like, there was a story in the newspaper about condo buildings needing to build separate rooms just to store the number of packages that were being delivered on any given day, and like residents volunteering to provide security for the daily deliveries. Why do you recommend shutting off one-click ordering?
Yes. One-click ordering almost always leads to some sort of impulse buying.
Yeah.
I get it. You want to make things as easy as possible. Your credit card information's in there. All you have to do is click. But listen, just take a second. You know, in that time when you're inputting your credit card information, you're putting in your address, you have a chance to kind of take a second look at what you're buying and if you really need it. And I totally believe that people are ordering like crazy right now and overspending. And so just adding a little bit of friction in that purchasing process will definitely save you some money.
Take it off. Credit reports. So in Canada, we now have, and like the US, we now have very, very easy ways for people to get their score for free and have that, you know, monitored and managed. Why do you believe getting your credit report is important? Because it is, that's a perfect 5-minute task. It doesn't take any longer than that.
Yeah. You know, your credit report is just a treasure trove of information. You know, it tells you what your financial health kind of looks like. And, you know, people think about their credit score as just, you know, oh, I'm in good financial health or I'm in bad financial health. But really, it's a tool to kind of, you know, help you qualify for a mortgage, help you qualify for loans. You know, there's so much good information in there. And something that people often forget is, you know, there can be mistakes on your credit report. And by going in, taking a look, you know, monitoring what's on there, you can actually even give yourself maybe some bonus points on your credit score if you see like an error on there.
You, like me, are fully engaged in this probably most of your working day. So I am talking about it. I'm focused on it. I am in it. When your folks pitch 5-minute money tasks, what has been one that you've heard and thought, oh, I like that one. That's good. Because I wouldn't have thought of shutting off one-click ordering. That one didn't occur to me. Do you have like a favorite or one that's like less conventional that you have liked?
Yeah, this one is a tiny bit less actionable, but one that I always think about is taking a second to learn about the recent money scams, especially in COVID times. Every single day there's a new money scam.
Yeah.
So just taking a little bit of time, reading up on it, learning what's out there, you can actually save yourself so much money in the long run and avoid, you know, a really detrimental scam.
Okay, I'm going to see that and raise it one. So here's my raising it one. Then after you've learned about the latest scams, take 5 minutes and call your parent or grandparent and tell them about the task. Because my mom's 84, almost 85, and she is with it. But she is not on top of the kind of scams that are out there these days. Can I add that one? Is that like a twofer?
Oh my gosh, that is such a good one. I have a 97-year-old grandma with an iPhone who is, you know, on Facebook. She's clicking things, you know, who knows what she's clicking on. So yes, take a second, reach out to your loved ones, make sure they're kind of in the know, because I'm telling you, you can really save yourself a lot of money.
Now, I did the plug for your newsletter. I get no toaster. I get no credit for that. I just really do find it to be super insightful. How do people sign up for Easy Money?
Yeah, you can go on policygenius.com/newsletter. And then, you know, you'll be getting it probably the next week. It's such a great resource to kind of learn about personal finance, whether you're at the beginning of your journey, you're in the middle of your journey. You know, we offer analysis of all the current events that are happening in the personal finance world. We have, you know, fun money gossip. And of course, we have those 5-minute money tasks.
Hannah, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Bruce.
Hannah Horvath is Deputy Managing Editor of Easy Money. The particular part of the newsletter that I love is their 5-minute money tasks. Check it out. Coming up next on Moo La La, mortgage rates are low, low, low. What you should know about how to get the best rates. And later, filing taxes is one of my least favorite tasks, like literally least favorite tasks. but I've got support to get it done. What if you don't have that support? And what if you have other life challenges and your income is low? We will talk about a program from a nonprofit called Momentum. That's coming up. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, do not worry. You can go to our website, moolala.ca, listen to past episodes there, or go to any of the podcast platforms. We are now on Amazon Prime too. So Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, all of them. And while you're there, review the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, and the next episode is going to show up right on your device.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Interest rates are hovering around record lows. It is ridiculous how low they are. For anyone who's been alive longer than 5 minutes, they know that this is kind of weird how low rates are. And the housing market is responding in kind. It is booming in most parts of the country. Not all, but most. Things are moving so fast, though. So what should you know about getting the best interest rate possible today? Joe Jacobs is a partner at Mortgage Connection. He is here to take us through what's going on right in this minute and what all that means for you. He joins us from Calgary, Alberta. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
It is March of 2021, and I say that because sometimes people listen to these conversations, you know, weeks or months after we have them, and things are moving so fast. The environment could be completely different in April or June. What are you noticing about the mortgage market right now?
Oh, yeah, that's a really important point there, Bruce. It is very dynamic. It's moving all the time. So something that we would have said 3 weeks ago is going to be very different than what we're going to say here today. So the big thing that we are seeing right now is, although we are still near record low interest rates, we are starting to see some of the fixed rates creeping up. Now, does that mean it's a sign of the absolute rock bottom rates being gone? Not necessarily. But it's something to be very aware of if you're potentially looking at remortgaging or if you're looking at getting into this very hot real estate market that you alluded to. So that's something that we've got to keep a keen eye on. What we've seen is that the bond markets have reacted in the way that's driving up pricing. So if you haven't been pre-approved and you're out looking or considering to shop, you certainly want to make sure you have something held. Just to protect yourself.
If you had a dollar for every time this question was asked of you, I'm sure you would no longer be running your business because you'd be a gazillionaire. Fixed versus variable. What are the pros and cons of going fixed right now in this moment versus a time when the spread was wider?
Sure. It's the big question that a lot of people are asking right now. So as I say, the fixed rates have started to creep up, but what has actually happened at the same time is banks have started to offer larger discounts off prime. So you're actually seeing the spread between the two of them become larger. So there's perhaps a bigger case to be made to go variable right now, just because the spread is getting bigger between the two. But if you're the type that is, you know, certainly worried about where rates are going to go, or you just want to not worry about it, a fix is a fine choice. But you're kind of catching them on, at least at this point, an uptick. So for many people, they like the variable because they're getting discounts that are close to a full percentage off prime or greater, depending on what they're in.
Really?
Yeah. So it's, you know, normally when you see that, I've never seen someone be upset when they're at close to a percentage off prime.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, I like that space because it gives you the most flexibility. But when you were still looking at rates that are sub 2% for fixed, if you're the type that doesn't want to think about it, you know, that can be the right choice for you too.
We often talk about people breaking their mortgage when they've got a fixed mortgage, and there are reasons to do that, to get a lower rate or whatever. If someone has a variable mortgage and they're at, you know, 40 basis points off prime, can they break their mortgage to get 1%? And if so, how much does that cost?
Yeah, that's a very good question. They certainly can. And one of the benefits of a variable rate mortgage is that your penalty cost is fairly reasonable. You're normally looking at 3 months simple interest with most variable type mortgages. So if you were at, say, 0.4% below it very well could make sense to redo that, get into a lower discount off the prime rate, especially if you're 100% committed to a variable. So that's something that's definitely available. And we're starting to see people come into that space. We really just started to see these bigger variable discounts start to come in the last few months. So that's a conversation that we're going to be having a lot more of in the coming months.
One of the other discussions that people have is, should I lock in? Should I lock in? Should I lock in? Should I lock in? What are the indicators that would have you advise a client to lock in?
Yeah, timing the rate market's always a tough thing. And, you know, one of the things that I think people do in a lot of spaces, and definitely in the mortgage spaces, they hear rates are going up or they're rising. So the first thing they think they have to do is lock in. And that's often a mistake, because you're kind of missing the opportunity that was maybe there and just chasing a rate market. So right now, just because rates are going up a bit, I wouldn't advise people that you need to jump out of a variable, especially if you're in a very good variable rate, just because interest rates are going up. There's two things we want to watch. Obviously, keep an eye on the fixed rates to see where they're going, but also keep an eye on that variable. If you have a really big discount, you're quite protected. So, we do have to make sure that we're paying attention to that, though, because those rates could go up if inflationary concerns happen and that sort of thing. But a rate going up doesn't mean you should lock in.
I was talking to a friend who just refinanced and saved a huge amount of money through that process, but they initiated the conversation with the broker. And they were annoyed that the broker hadn't initiated that conversation. How proactive are great brokers in telling clients that they should or could make a move to save money? Is there any incentive for you to do that other than you're going to assure your place in heaven?
There certainly is a lot more of that that a seasoned and good mortgage broker would be doing. So there's always opportunities that will present themselves throughout the year. Sometimes people though think that they should do something just because interest rates are lower, but the math's really not there. But I would say that most mortgage brokers, if they're doing a good job for their clients, are going to be on top of changing markets that could save them money. Again, though, like the variable one that I gave you as an example, we're just starting to see that come into place now. So, does it make sense just because it's slightly better, 25 basis points better, to make a call and change your mortgage when there's indicators that it could become 50% better? So just because you didn't get a call from your mortgage broker, I wouldn't say it's not that they're not on top of it, but certainly a good broker would be for you.
What has happened to some of the features that that lenders typically offer? So in calmer times, we talk a lot about lump sums and we talk about payment vacations and, you know, there's various things that you can, the ways you can structure it. How have those changed?
Not really to any significant degree. Most lending institutions are still offering fairly decent prepayment options. A lot have those kind of skip a payment options built in. The only time you have to be kind of worried on what features may not be in the mortgage if you're going into a more basic mortgage. So sometimes there's really low interest rates that are being promoted or sold by lending institutions, but they have restrictions, whether it's a lower prepayment or you can't get out of your mortgage early. And some of those things can trap you. But in general, you're going to have fairly good options still to pay your mortgage off more aggressively as long as you're with them. Feature product.
What are some of the pitfalls that you have been seeing in these times? Like, they really, should have thought about whether they could port their mortgage because people are moving and they're taking that hit. Or what are some of the pitfalls that that people should really be aware of as a part of this, part of their financial mosaic?
Yeah, I think it's, I've talked about this a lot in the past, but it's just features of a mortgage beyond just that interest rate. So the real one that I think hit home for a lot of people is if they took what they thought was a great mortgage rate, say a fixed rate 2 years ago at 3%, and then when rates were falling, they want to get out of their mortgage to save money. They maybe even were contacted by the mortgage broker and they couldn't do it because they were with a product that literally doesn't allow them to pay their mortgage out early. So it's really important to be paying attention to the features beyond just the interest rate, because the cheapest interest rate doesn't necessarily mean it's going to save you the most money. We've seen lots of times where it's not.
There are so many headlines and so many variables for people to keep on top of if they choose to understand what's going to happen in the housing market, but more specifically, the mortgage market. If you had to choose one thing to watch that would indicate what is going to alter mortgage rates in this country, what would it be? Is it vaccine rates? Is it an economic indicator? What's the thing that you watch more than any other thing?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest concern on why rates would go up is if there is inflationary concerns. So we're in a really low rate environment right now, but obviously the housing market's done extremely well, better than I think most people thought. And that's a big driver for economic growth. So if we continue to see things going in that direction and, you know, we see other economic data coming out that shows that there's gains overall, then inflationary concerns become real. And that's where you could start to see the Bank of Canada raise interest rates and you could see fixed rates go up as well.
Joe, thank you for your insight today.
My pleasure, Bruce.
Joe Jacobs is a partner at Mortgage Connection. He's based in Calgary. Things are moving. Talk to your broker, talk to your lender. Keep on top of this. It could really pay out for you. Stay with us. Coming up later on the program, The Women's Guide to Successful Investing. Nancy Tengler on what women need to focus on that's different from men. But first, tips on filing taxes. Now, don't forget to stay up to date on all things Moolala. Sign up for our newsletter. It brings together all the different things I've been doing on CBC Radio and this show on Sirius XM and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. It only comes once a month, and I will never do anything with your email address. I promise.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Filing taxes can be confusing at the best of times. It is no surprise that it can be even more confusing with all that's going on in this pandemic and the various government supports coming in and out and how do we treat them. This is especially true for those living on a low or lower income. Joining us now to talk more about this topic and a program that they offer is Jeff Loomis. He is Executive Director of Momentum, an Alberta-based nonprofit that provides a number of programs and services, including those focused on financial literacy. Also joining Jeff is Erland, a participant in this particular Momentum program. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff, make the case for why people with a lower income should file their taxes in the first place. Because I think some people might think, yeah, I'm not making much money. Like, why would I even bother?
Yeah, tax filing is so critical for many Canadians. And then it's even more important when people are living on a lower income so that people can access benefits that can really just help make ends meet. So a really tangible example is the Alberta and Canada Child Benefit, as well as GST rebates. Those are really well-known benefits that you can only access in Canada if you file your taxes. Mm. And a family living on lower incomes, say around $31,000 a year, they're eligible to receive just in the Canada Child Benefit, almost $7,000, but they have to file their taxes to get it.
It's a big incentive. Can you describe the essence of what Momentum is trying to do here? What's the program? How does it work? What do they learn?
So Momentum, with a number of community partners, host volunteer tax clinics. And it's just to make it a lot easier for people to file their taxes. Because if people living on lower incomes are not able to file their taxes, they can lose out on thousands of dollars of benefits that they're eligible to receive.
Erland, how did you hear about this program and what was your experience in it?
Well, I started out essentially having some mental health issues and suffering from depression. And that kind of put me in the wrong mindset. And I kind of withdrew from society for a while, became homeless and unavailable to badly needed resources. I found that we need to ensure that our taxes are accurate and up to date, because otherwise you do not have access to federal, provincial, or municipal programs. And that can be just enough to actually elevate you out of homelessness back into being a contributing member of society.
So you heard about this program, and did you go to a class, or was it a website, or how did it actually unfold? I mean, my fantasy version is I wouldn't have to do anything and Momentum would just do all the work. But my hunch is it was more involved than that.
No, that was almost all it was.
Really?
I signed a piece of paper saying that I allow them to be my guardian for tax purposes. They were able to contact Revenue Canada, get all the missing T4s. They filed all the paperwork for me. All I had to do was show up and sign each separate application with my own signature. And soon enough, I actually got a bit of a money back. And that was enough to, like I said, raise me out of being homeless back to being semi-participant.
Wow. How did that feel for you?
It was a huge relief. Even if you owe Revenue Canada money, you should still file, because they can see in their system that you're not earning money. They can see in their systems that you're accessing benefits. So even if you owe money, file your paperwork.
Yeah. Wow. Jeff, what are some of the barriers, the common barriers that people living on a lower income are facing when they come to you?
Yeah, I think many Canadians experience barriers, and then those barriers become even more pronounced if people have additional challenges, whether it's just living on low incomes and having huge scarcity of time, or whether it's not knowing English very well because you're new to Canada. And our tax system has become increasingly complex over the last number of years. And so that's the biggest barrier, it's just a level of complexity. And a lot of people don't understand how to file, where to go to get tax filing help. And there's also a huge perception, like Erlyn described, of people oftentimes living on low incomes just don't feel they need to file. And they don't have the understanding that by actually filing, you can get a whole bunch of benefits. And it's not that you're necessarily going to owe the government money. So those are some of the big barriers that people experience across the country.
We also can't underplay the reality of the pandemic that we're in, just in terms of access. How did you need to change the way you brought this program to life, given that you can't as easily have people gather? You can't just say, hey, swing by our offices and we'll have a group of you in a room and we'll, you know, figure this out for you. How did you have to change how you make it work?
Yeah, the biggest change is that Momentum's community partners, organizations like Sunrise Community Link here in Calgary, they offer free tax clinics. And those tax clinics for years were offered in person. And because of the restrictions of COVID, here in Calgary, we had to shift, and across the country, we've had to shift to virtual tax clinics. And so that has been the biggest challenge. But even with that challenge, we helped thousands of people last year to be able to file their taxes and access millions of dollars in benefits. So I encourage everyone across Canada that is unsure about how to file taxes is to check out www.canada.ca and look up free tax clinics, because they are available across the country in all of our communities. And there's community organizations like here in Calgary that host those volunteer-based tax clinics.
Erlyn, you talked about the fact that CRA could look you up based on your, you know, social insurance number and see that you're receiving benefits. How have you found your personal experience of navigating the supports that are out there in this time? What was that like for you?
It was absolutely essential, because without having filed for the previous year, there's nothing they can do to help you for your current year. And essentially the anxiety is what got to me. I got a resource from a city source. They gave me the local group that I contacted. I contacted them and they basically took a hold of the situation right away, to the point where I wasn't anxious no more. All I had to do was wait, sign some papers, wait a bit longer, and my situation entirely turned around. Mm.
Jeff, you mentioned the Government of Canada website, canada.ca, and search for free tax clinics. The Momentum program is more in-depth than that. Given that we are speaking to a national audience here, how would our listeners in other parts of the country find, I'm using air quotes here, the equivalent to what Momentum offers, you know, or in that broad neighborhood of what you offer?
Yeah, there's a number of community-based organizations like Momentum across the country that are doing a lot of work so that people living on lower incomes are able to learn more about money, be able to reduce their debt through financial coaching, and then build savings so that people can actually move ahead. And so if people Google financial literacy and their community, or financial empowerment and their community, they can identify some of those local community organizations. And then a national organization, Prosper Canada, has done a lot of work at a national level. And they're also a great resource to help then connect into local community resources.
Jeff, what if you had a magic wand and really were focused on making a difference for low-income individuals and families as it related to personal finance and financial literacy, what would be the single biggest thing that you would focus on?
Yeah, I think the biggest change that we could make in our country is to simplify the tax system and then to actually make auto enrollment happen more so that people didn't have to go through the same challenges that Erland's gone through. Erland is not alone. In Alberta, 15% of working age Albertans don't file their taxes, and only 3% of Calgarians living in homelessness access the GST tax credit. So it's a huge issue across our country, because we have made more and more benefits available through the tax system. But the tax system is complex and has barriers. So if we could actually create auto enrollment for people to be able to access those benefits, that would make a huge difference to reduce the anxiety and the barriers that folks like Erland have experienced.
Jeff, thank you for your leadership at Momentum and for this program in particular, helping folks get sorted on the taxes. We really appreciate that. And Erland, thank you for joining us to talk about your personal experience. It's one thing for us to talk in theory about the challenges that people are dealing with. It's an entirely different conversation when we have someone willing to bring their story, be authentic, and talk about the road you have walked. We really appreciate it.
Even if only one person has helped, it is well worth it. Thank you for having me.
Erland is a participant in the Momentum Tax Program. Jeff Loomis is Executive Director of Momentum, an Alberta-based nonprofit that provides a number of programs and financial and services in the area of financial literacy and other areas too. Stay with us. Coming up next, there are differences between men and women when it comes to investing. Experience says so, and data says so. We're going to talk about what women and the men who support them can do to improve their success with investing. Nancy Tengler is the author of The Women's Guide to Successful Investing. Listen, if you've got any money questions, no matter your gender, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Women invest differently than men. It's true. Sometimes it is in their favor, and sometimes it is not, because of systemic and cultural barriers that make for an uneven playing field. Nancy Tengler is the Chief Investment Officer of Laffer Tengler Investments. Her book is The Women's Guide to Successful Investing. And it takes you through how you can manage your finances and come up with a great, great financial plan. She joins us from Scottsdale, Arizona. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
There is a very compelling case to be made for why we need to focus on women, and not just because of equity, but because women are likely to live longer than men. And so if they happen to be married to a guy, there is in all likelihood going to be a period when they are solo and when they need to manage their own money. I mean, it doesn't get any more clear than that when it comes to vested interest. That's one of the reasons I get fired up about this. The other is I have an 11-year-old daughter. What gets you fired up about this?
Thank you. It is my passion. I wrote the book because I met, I was in the investment business. I retired, went and got an MFA in creative writing. And so I met all these women that I hadn't had time to meet before at sporting events, et cetera, advanced degrees, you know, medical doctors, dentists, and to a person, when they asked what I did, and I said, oh, I used to be chief investment officer, which I am again, they would recoil and say, oh, I leave that to my husband. And so here were very smart women who knew, and still, by the way, nationwide, the majority know little to nothing about not just their finances, but how the assets are invested. And so this leads to, because you rightly point out that we tend to live 5 years longer, the average age of a widow in the United States is 59. Wow. And so, and I was very surprised by that until I became one of the statistics. And you're not ready. You think you have plenty of time. In my case, I was fortunate because I managed the family wealth, but most women don't, and they don't have any understanding of where things are. They don't have a relationship with the financial advisor. So they end up not having trust. And often 2/3 of the time they fire the investment advisor. And then that's expensive and disruptive in their lives at a time when they don't need that. So I determined to work with women, to educate women on how accessible investing is, because the research shows that women actually make better investors than men.
I want to get to that because it's fascinating. But before we do, why do you think women are more likely to defer investment management decisions to a husband if they happen to be heterosexual, but to men? Why do you think that is?
I think because we've excused ourselves. I think it's partly our fault. We've excused ourselves from the conversation, but we've never been encouraged to participate. And so, you know, plus add to the fact that most women are pretty darn busy. If they're single mothers raising a family and working, or if they've got a whole family and they're not working. I mean, the busiest time in my life was when I stopped working and I had to drive carpool and go to Costco, and it was a nightmare. So I think that's part of it. But the discouraging fact is that millennial women defer at a lower rate than, I'm sorry, baby boomer women defer at a lower rate than millennial women. So the trend is going in the wrong direction.
Right. It is interesting insight, because of all the household duties, and I'm stereotyping here, a male is more likely to raise his hand to take care of the investment portfolio, perhaps, than make dinner or care for aging parents or change yet another diaper.
That's so true. In my marriage, my husband was an only child. And I don't know if you have much information on only children, but I didn't do the dishes correctly, thank God. So we did them for our entire marriage, which has proven to be quite a problem lately that I'm on my own. But I managed the assets.
Yes. Well, my husband's the youngest of five, and he has told me that not only do I do the dishes wrong, he loads the dishwasher wrong. So at least we're even on that front. I want to talk, you referenced this, the strengths that women have in investing. There is a study that articulates the returns versus men. And part of the benefit seems to be because they trade less often. Tell me about the net of it, why returns tend to be better, and what insight that can provide for women who are really trying to learn more in this area.
So that's a great question. Bruce, we have a real live lab on this right now with GameStop. It wasn't the women that were jumping in and speculating, because that really is speculation, but it was mostly men. And the reason that the lack of trading, or the lower amount of trading that women engage in, is more productive is because, first of all, your after-tax total return is going to be better. And stocks need 3 to 5 years to outperform or to generate the kind of returns we're looking for. But if you, and this is what the study showed, it was men, boys will be boys, gender and overconfidence, I think was the title of the study. Women held their securities longer and they outperformed married men by 1% per year over the 10-year period. That's a lot when that compounds over a very long period of time. They outperformed single men by 3% annually.
Wow.
So the sort of juicy competitive nature was much greater for single men who are competing against a benchmark. Women are doing more research, and that's also empirically proven. And they're willing to hold stocks. I call them stocks to own for a lifetime, for a much longer period of time, because they've done their research and because they're not as competitive.
And the single straight men are spending a lot of money on black leather couches for their man boobs. So that's expensive. That's not free. Your book, The Women's Guide to Successful Investing, you've got these intelligent investing rules. Give us two or three of your favorites.
Okay. So I think in order, the first one is that you've got to establish your life goals early and stick to your plan. But if you think that you've waited too long and that it's hopeless, I would encourage you to reconsider that. One of the examples I give is a nurse who recently passed away at the ripe old age of 100 plus. But she didn't begin investing. Her name is Stephanie Muka, and she didn't begin investing until she was in retirement on a fixed income. And yet when she died, she had given away $3 million and she still had $2.5 million in her portfolio. So if she could build that kind of wealth on a fixed income. Now, she had a lot of years to do it. She had about almost 40 years, but still, and she had no formal training. So I encourage women, retirement is 20 years of unemployment. You can start anytime. You just have to adjust the kind of stocks you own if you have a short, you know, a super short period of time.
Was there one other that you want to highlight there?
Yes. Don't run with the fast crowd. And
that's like wisdom for how I should have done high school.
Exactly. But especially now when you've got, you know, social influencers tweeting about the stocks they're buying, Reddit, the Redditors, GameStop and other names, if you buy what you know, I cite a bunch of mistakes I made in the book. So by the end of it, you're going to say, why am I listening to her? But it was always because I took tips from people I didn't know, or I bought something I didn't understand. And so what I've focused on myself is you buy stocks you can own for a lifetime, products you use, companies you know that have a great reputation, and you just keep adding to them.
I want to ask one more question before we go. And that is, many, many of our listeners work with professional financial advisors to varying degrees of success. What is one tip you would have for women out there to ensure that they get the best value out of that relationship? Because I know anecdotally, many women, many clients overall, but many women in particular, feel like they can't ask questions or somehow advisor knows best, and they aren't ensuring that that relationship really works for them.
That's an awesome question. And again, it's why I wrote the book. And I've had women come up to me and say, you know, my advisor treats me with more respect now because I understand the language. But also I have a chapter on how to select an advisor and the questions you should be asking them. But here's the issue. You ask your advisor not only what is his fee, because, or her fee, because that's important, right? But what are the fees on the investments that he or she may be putting you in? Because those come out at the fund level. So if you're in ETFs or mutual funds, if that's what your advisor uses, I don't do that. I use individual securities, but most advisors do. And so you're paying your advisor a fee to put you in other funds that also have a fee. And that ensures pretty much that you can never beat the market. And it has a hugely negative impact on your total return 20 years out, because fees compound just like dividend growth and interest rates do, and not to your advantage.
Yeah. Well, hopefully people will take some of your advice to put to their advantage. Nancy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Nancy Tengler is the Chief Investment Officer of Lafler Tengler and the author of The Women's Guide to Successful Investing. That's a great insight there. That is our show for today. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, super simple to do. We have a newsletter. You can sign up for that newsletter at moolala.ca. You can go to any of the podcast platforms and sign up for a subscription to the podcast version of this show. I am the money columnist for a TV show called Cityline. The URL for that show is cityline.tv. It's on air across North America. On social, my Twitter handle is @BruceCelery. On Facebook, my, I don't know, what do you call it? Page? Don't say fan page, because that's so obnoxious. But you can find me at Bruce Celery, Celery, Moolala. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.